Wintry mix slowly pushing south and east, but then it will eventually turn to rain as milder air pushes in. Highs again of around 6 to 8 degrees. The outlook less cold for Thursday night into Friday, so frost free here. The rain will be pretty slow moving and heavy at times though as it pushes across England and Wales, but the rain will take its time to reach southeast England. Brighter behind for Scotland and Northern Ireland, milder for all, 7 to 9 degrees the high. That's your weather.
Thanks very much, Louise. Now, in the last days of Detroit, the author Mark Benelli attends a gun class and hears the stark arguments that find favour when crime runs out of control.
If you were to make the 5-minute walk east from Mark Covington's Georgia Street Community Garden to Gratiot Avenue, then turn north and stroll a single block, you would reach the Slumberland Child Development Center. In a city of haunted ruins, it takes special elan to stand out as an unusually haunted ruin. For the Slumberland Child Development Center, the crude mural featuring Mickey Mouse and the Tasmanian Devil provides that extra boost, especially if you live in the neighborhood and happen to know the recent history of the place. How in 2009 and again in 2010, the former daycare center was used to hide the cadavers of two murder victims. Including the Slumberland corpses, the bodies of 8 women were discovered in the immediate vicinity over the same time period. 2 years on, there had been no arrests in connection with the killings. In one of the local articles on the case, a resident wondered if the neighborhood was becoming a mecca for dumping bodies. Though his community garden earns most of the attention, Mark Covington also serves as vice president of a group called the City Airport Renaissance Association. As the body count piled up, the members of CARA, dedicated to stabilizing what remained of their neighborhood, began knocking on doors and distributing flyers warning residents of the killings. If you ask a Detroiter about saving the city, it's unlikely that they will mention tech startups or urban farming. The first thing most Detroiters want to talk about is crime. Along with groups like CARA and organized anti-crime patrols like the Detroit 300, private citizens, in do-it-yourself Detroit fashion, attempted to fill the void left by the hobbled police department, which possessed one of the worst 911 response times in the country. Non-priority callers could expect waits close to an hour. Not coincidentally, Metro Detroit accounted for 43% of all concealed weapons permits, CCWs, issued in the entire state of Michigan. It could get sort of crazy. A few days after the new city council was elected in the fall of 2009, it was reported that 5 of its 9 members had CCW permits and regularly carried firearms. Around the same time, a robber made the mistake of breaking into the Westside Bible Church, where he was promptly shot by the pastor. A resourceful AP reporter had followed up on the gun-slinging minister story by conducting a quick poll of Detroit churches and managed to turn up a number of other armed men of the cloth, including Holy Hope Heritage's Reverend William Reveille, who admitted to occasionally preaching while wearing his 357, and Greater Grace Temple's Bishop Charles Ellis III, who insisted he didn't wear his concealed weapon during services, but then again, he didn't have to, as the church had its own armed 18-member Ministry of Defense present at all major functions. To obtain a CCW permit in Michigan, one must first complete a gun safety and proficiency class with someone like Rick Echter, the proprietor of Rick's Firearm Academy, who was quoted in the AP story. Echter said he taught pastors and people from all walks of life. As he explained it, Detroit is not a very safe place. On Echter's website, he'd splashed across the top of the page, "If you live, work, or play in Detroit, you need a CCW." Below this imperative, visitors could stroll through such statements as, "Detroit is the most violent city in the USA. Each and every single day within the Detroit city limits, one person will be murdered. 2 people will be forcibly raped. 19 people will be robbed. And 36 people will be victims of an aggravated assault." I was surprised to discover, via the website, that Echter was African-American. In a case of reverse stereotyping, I'd always considered this specific type of right-to-bear-arms proselytizing as distinctly Caucasian behavior. Curious, I gave Hector a call, and he invited me to take a class. The next one would take place on a Sunday, in the bland conference room of a suburban hotel located on a freeway service drive, beginning at 8 a.m. sharp. There were 9 other students, 6 of them women, everyone black, but for a Polish-accented man who looked about 6'5". Hector stood at the front of the room, 42 years old, fit, conservatively dressed, blue slacks, tucked dress shirt, with short hair and a 5 o'clock shadow. By day, he worked as a systems analyst for a company whose major client was one of the big 3 auto companies. Hector's pedagogical style seemed the product of a Dale Carnegie-inspired handbook on effective public speaking. He projected his crisply enunciated words toward the back of the room and made deliberate eye contact with each of his students, occasionally underlining a point with a sudden and intense grin. Unlike Carnegie, however, Hector was wearing a pair of bulky handguns, visibly holstered on either hip. Among the other students, there was one young couple, a paunchy retirement-aged man, and a compact, fussily made-up woman in a camouflage Detroit Tigers cap. The woman had brought along her own handgun in a black carrying case. Seated directly beside me, a pretty, broad-faced woman with a regal posture took copious notes on a yellow legal pad. Even the students who didn't take notes listened raptly as Hector worked his central thesis: the crucial necessity of constant vigilance and hyper-awareness of one's surroundings, sleep being the only exemption. If you're a heavy sleeper, Hector recommended buying a dog. Hector laid out a number of be-aware scenarios where a crime might occur. Some seemed universally applicable: a car following you home. Others specific to Detroit: a car stopping next to yours at a red light after dark. The class covered practical gun-related concerns, the pluses and minuses of various calibered handguns, the inefficiency of certain pistols, how the difference between store-bought and home-swaged bullets was akin to the difference between an off-the-rack and a custom suit, and how hollow-point bullets tended to solve the penetration problem. "At what point does someone stop being a threat to you?" Hector asked the class. A woman in a faded teal sweatshirt raised her hand. The effort seemed to exhaust her. "When they can't move?" she asked. "You shoot until he stops," Hector shouted, his eyes flashing as if lit by gunpowder. Lowering his voice, he continued, "You may have to shoot a person more than once. You may have to shoot a person a lot of times. It's getting colder, so people wear a lot of clothes. A person might be high on drugs." His voice turning grave, Hector told us it was better not to carry a gun at all than to have one and not be prepared to pull the trigger. "Do you have it in you to defend yourself?" he asked. "Or would you pull out your gun and wave it around and hope they magically disappear?" The "they" referred to a would-be assailant. He paused, arranging his face into a disgusted look, before continuing, "What if your assailant is 12 years old?" A few months earlier, a 12-year-old boy had indeed been arrested in Detroit for murder after shooting a young woman during an attempted carjacking. "What if," Hector went on, "a 12-year-old with a shotgun in his pants rolls up on a bicycle? Would you have it in you to shoot him?" A low chorus of yeses rose from the seats, though one of the women began, "Depends on how big—" Hector interrupted. "If you are not prepared to shoot a 12-year-old, you should not carry a handgun." "If he's big enough to point a gun in your face, he's big enough to take a bullet." A plurality of my classmates nodded approvingly. Eventually, Hector introduced the attorney who would lecture us on the specific instances in which we could legally defend ourselves. You weren't allowed to shoot someone for trying to steal your car, but if that same person made the mistake of breaking into your home, you, the homeowner, could assume that person meant you bodily harm, and so you had permission to shoot to kill, thanks to a law passed in 2006, eliminating a gun owner's so-called duty to retreat. When the lawyer finished this section of his talk, he said, "Okay, so that's how you get to shoot someone." During one of the breaks, Hector stepped outside for a cigarette and I joined him for a chat. He said he'd been uninterested in guns until 7 years prior, when he'd been robbed in his own driveway. He lived in Rosedale Park, a neighborhood on the northwest side that holds a reputation as one of Detroit's more stable. One night in October, he'd arrived home after dark and, exiting his car, found two teenagers waiting in the shadows, one packing a gun. The kids ordered him to sit down in his driveway and empty his pockets. Ector had so little cash, they attempted to force him to drive to an ATM, but he managed to convince them he had wildly overdrawn his account after a long night at the bar. "They weren't that big," Ector told me. "Average kids. I think I could have took them, but I'll never know, because they had a gun and I didn't." The next day, he went to his local police precinct and asked about acquiring a permit. "They tried to discourage me," Ector said. "The solution is not everyone getting a gun. That only adds to the problem." It incensed me a little bit. I thought, "You were not there when I got robbed." Today, Ector evangelizes for gun rights with the zeal of a recent convert. Sometimes, just to test himself, he'll attempt to get through an entire day without allowing a single stranger to get within 10 feet of him. He allots himself 1 point if he spots the stranger approaching, and penalizes himself 10 points if someone sneaks up behind him. Citing more Detroit crime statistics, Ector went on, "You know, there's no civil liability if the police don't respond in a timely manner. You're officially on your own. The chief of police called Detroit the Wild Wild West. Detroit gets picked on a lot, sometimes unfairly, but a lot of the criticism is justified. It's really bad in the city now. If the city is this bad, I think as a public service, they'd come out and say, go buy a gun for your protection until we get it together." Ector also pointed out that some of Michigan's earliest restrictions on gun possession came in direct response to the Ossian Sweet case. In September 1925, Sweet, an African-American doctor, moved into a white neighborhood on Detroit's east side with his wife and infant daughter. The booming automobile industry had resulted in severe housing shortages in the city's black ghettos, forcing Sweet, upwardly mobile and ambitious but no rabble-rousing activist, to risk crossing Detroit's clearly demarcated lines of segregation. Shortly after the family's move, a mob of angry whites gathered in the street and began to pelt the home with rocks and bricks, eventually storming the front door. In the ensuing melee, shots were fired by either Sweet or one of his dinner guests, and two white men were wounded, one fatally. Sweet, his wife, and seven other men present were arrested and put on trial for murder. The defendant's eventual acquittal is considered a milestone of the modern civil rights movement and has been chronicled in gripping detail by Kevin Boyle in his 2005 book, Arc of Justice. "He was a very successful doctor who wanted to move to a nice, diverse neighborhood where he wasn't wanted," was how Ector put it. "That law was designed strictly for the purpose of denying people of color from getting firearms." Ector admitted that the National Rifle Association had an image problem when it came to race. "People hear NRA and they think militias, rednecks," he said. "But there are other black people in the NRA. Not many walk around with a black NRA cap like me." He smiled ironically. "Actually," Ector told me, "I don't think the NRA goes far enough."
The Last Days of Detroit by Mark Benelli was abridged by Pete Nichols and read by John Schwab. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. Good morning. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015, today, Thursday, the 14th of March. There are warnings of gales in Shannon, Rockall, Malin and southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low, west of Iceland, 1007, expected Bailey 993 by 1800 Thursday. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. Viking, north Utsira, south Utsira. Variable 3 or 4, becoming southeasterly 5 or 6 later. Snow showers, good, occasionally poor. 40s, Cromarty, 4th. West or northwest, 4 or 5. Backing south, 5 or 6 later. Wintry showers, rain later, good, occasionally poor. Tyne, Dogger. Northwest, backing southwest later, 4 or 5. Wintry showers.